Hey, folks, that was just a great reading. Thank you, everybody, for being here. And thank you to our readers, who are just amazingly great. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. We have 7 readers, and we're encouraging them to read 2 poems if they'd like to do that. And we're actually going to do a recording. We're doing a recording of all of these, as you know, and they're always on the web, on the blog, so you can listen in, and you can also download. And so I'm going to get everybody settled in because Aaron, you can read it twice if you feel like it. Okay? But you think once will be enough? Okay. Well, Aaron's poem is going to be sent out to a British journal, and they'll be posting his poem along with the printed version plus this audio. So we're going to try to be really quiet. And I'm going to wait till everybody stop talking.
And applaud, and applaud. Really loud.
Okay, so. We're gonna do the open mic now. Oh yay! All right. Please welcome our first open mic reader, Aaron Novick.
Thanks. And I actually prefer that there's no applause on the recording. So you can applaud loudly if you want, but don't feel obliged, and please wait about 3 seconds after I'm done if you do want to. Thanks. This poem has no title. It appears crooked, that half-submerged stick, but it is not. How much mischief hides in that appears? How much more in that is not? A whole world of confusion. No, 2, the real one and the apparent alike dwell there by their requited antipathy sustained. Stick, you are a trickster, wearing now this face, now that, shrugging off each as the medium demands. Now you resemble a stick, straight enough, hung half in water, half air, tossing off light, in patterns wholly sensible under such conditions. Do I ask too much of you, stick? You're only a stick. Still, no thoughts but in things. Maybe better. No things but in thoughts. It comes to the same. My eye, unused to light and water, denies the water, though it sees it, certain, only air. World's the fruit of this first disobedience. Worlds that split you, stick, in 2, real and less than real, body and shadow. Do I ask too much of you? But I ask only that you appear as you are, and this you do without my asking. What is more, I trust, stick, I am not boring you with all this babbling. I have heard a most curious report. I have heard no stick. I have heard no air, no water, no light, no things, no thoughts.
Good job. Wow. So at some point, maybe Aaron will tell us when this comes out. It's in a British journal called Antiphon, and it's published in the UK, and it's a really interesting journal. You can look it up. And our next poet who's reading tonight in the open mic is Dean Hazelton. Please welcome Dean.
Okay, and it's all right to read 2?
Mm-hmm. Good.
Yeah, this first poem is a haibun, a combination of prose and haiku with a couple of tanka thrown in because of, what the hell, I'm a rebel. It's called Garden Lessons, so I hope there are a few gardeners out there among all you dazzling urbanites. Garden books give good advice. Design before you plant. Know your soil, tend your light. Plant for your temperature zone. Keep all in harmony through the rhythm of the seasons. Pick plants to appeal to all your senses. Work hard. Dig, prune, pull weeds, mulch extravagantly. Feed your plants well. Repeat. Repeat again. Continue. All good advice. But how should you live your garden? Don't use a book. Find your own way. Let your soul loaf. Amble. Touch. Look around. Attend. Sit. Sparkling beads of dew glisten in dawn's first sunbeams on a blue hosta. Colors change as clouds come and go, passing over the sun's face. Sunstruck clematis glow like luminous grapes, fade, then shine again. Birds mob the feeders and scatter seeds for chipmunks and squirrels. Joshua, my neighbor's old arthritic cat, creaks by to the shrill of the bird's fierce catcalls. 10 years ago, old Joshua hunted birds here. Now they scold him. A goldfinch darts by, like a tropical fish in a coral reef. He lights upside down on the feeder and pecks out thistle seed. Another comes, then two. He looks up, then flies, scattering light as he goes, perches on a branch, golden plumage camouflaged by the dapples of the sun. It's hot and dry, so water everything. Be the garden's thunderstorm. Fairy candles droop, their white stalks ablaze as sun burns candles. As evening comes, enjoy the peaceful cool. Wave away the mosquitoes and savor the firefly's ghostly light. Enjoy the gathering dark before you surrender the garden to the night. Shadows merge to dark. Fireflies flash to each other. The silent deer come in, graze warily on hosta, and make the garden their own. Thank you. This next one is entirely different. There's even a grain of truth in it. It's called A Man of Principle, and I knew somebody who did some of this stuff that I met during my meteoric teaching career in southeastern Massachusetts. A Man of Principle. John Harper knew injustice. He'd seen its leering face at Yale. One night when he returned from drinking in New Haven's bars, he found his dorm room locked. He couldn't reach his key, locked safe inside. And so he kicked the door to pieces and staggered through the splinters to his bed. Yale fixed the door, then showed its oppressive face by charging him for the damage. "I won't pay," John railed. "The university has failed in its duty. It shouldn't build such dorms which prevent their residents from using them. It's of the essence of a door, not just to keep people out, but also to let them in." This was a case of principle. He had been wronged. Tenaciously, he refused to pay the charge, but Yale kept it on his tab. When his time came to graduate, the university demanded payment, a door for a diploma. So John left Yale with no degree. He needed shelter and a job. A farmer friend offered space that fit his budget, a disused chicken coop. We helped him clean it out and moved it to a place in the Great Woods, secluded but close enough to town and jobs, 10 by 15 feet. Big enough for 40 chickens, or one man and his principals. Screened windows to bar mosquitoes the size of hens. John added a space heater and a bed, two chairs and a small table. "Space enough for Henry David Thoreau will do for me," he said, "so long as there's a proper door." He settled in to live a self-reliant life. As winter came, he learned the limits of wool and down, but stuck to his resolve. Local celebrity warmed his heart, but not his feet. Yet still, he persevered. In February's deep freeze, his father, a man of plastic principles, settled up with Yale. Flush with the triumph of principles defended and in the warmth of his new, well-heated flat, John reassessed his options. he soon learned a well-known fact. A Yale diploma opens doors. His work experience was limited to how to make a chicken coop a home, but his Ivy League education had taught him how to learn from a negative case. He saw that experience prepared him for a rewarding career in real estate development. In time, he carved up the Great Woods into luxury subdivisions. You've seen the ads, Great Woods Estates, because building for your comfort and security is our guiding principle. Thank you.
Very nice. Wow. Wow. So our next poet is Sawyer Braun. Please welcome Sawyer.
Thank you, Don. This is called Two Small Holes. I see a teenage Afghan troop writhing in the sand, a dark spot on his sky blue uniform growing like a Rorschach ink splotch spreading across his back. Hesitating, staring, I lie on the ground, transfixed on its morphing shape. Jumping to my feet, I forget the weight I carry. Slowly shuffling before working up the courage to sprint, body armor swaying in rhythm to my swinging arms, the heavy thud of rifle magazines thumping against Kevlar, a softer sound than the pounding heart, leaping through my throat and into my ears, cardiac cacophony, the only thing I can hear since firing my M4, ba-dum, 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 at 160 beats per minute. He only weighs 100 pounds. 100 pounds of struggle, confusion, fear, apprehension. I can't tell him to calm down. I can't tell him that I'll take care of him. I can't tell him he's in good hands, with no common tongue between us. All he knows is pain and panic. Can't hide it, can't run from it, can't even move his legs. Ripping off his shirt, I expose his wounds to the harsh noon sun. I am unimpressed by two dime-sized holes. Two tiny holes. Entrance and exit. So much damage between those holes. 7.62 millimeter, 850 meters per second. Spleen, liver, diaphragm. Ruptured, fissured, torn by hot steel at high velocity. It's not even bleeding, not on the outside. I can't see tunneled tissue with my tunnel vision. Nothing I can do about it. The best treatment is a rapid evac. I dress his wounds and tape the bandages to his skin. He wails, pleading with words I don't understand, begging for mercy I can't give. Another Afghan trooper hovers over my shoulder. I pull him down by the collar. I put his hand in his. Just say anything, I yell, as if saying it louder will translate better. I roll out a small canvas litter, carry him another 200 meters to the landing zone. He holds my wrist and won't let go. Through a small defilade, used as the Afghan's toilet, burning lungs, running nostrils, watering eyes, nimble feet. The bird is 5 minutes away. I reassess his wounds. Where the fuck is the bandage? Heavy sweat peeled the adhesive, applying another bandage to his cool, clammy skin. He feels so cold. I wrap him in a blanket to keep him warm. It's 105 degrees today. Why is he so cold?
That is a very tough story and a very good poem. Thank you. Thank you. Our next poet is Ryan Regan. Please welcome Ryan.
I have to follow that. All right. I didn't realize I get to read two, so I had to dig. This one's called An Apology. My apology is for the nothingness I now bring, the presence of blasphemy it entails. I had no idea how poor a banquet table I made until the plates were falling from my back. Last night in the shower, I thought of hurting myself on a pound and a half of dangerous drugs, of opening my head with a rock to end the ransom on these thoughts, moss racing out to trace the last photons of light, the dust dancing. There's a plague now in all of my motions, because I've said what I can and it won't be enough. There will still be me. When this started, I had a need for crucifixion, and we worked because you were looking for salvation. And do you recall our conversation about the differences between fucking and making love, and whether one was holy, and not being old enough to know it could be both? After parsing this act, we lauded our bodies, designs of self-congratulation, and you said you don't believe in ghosts, but this was before the pregnancy scare. And haunting would come on words that cannot be taken back, like a bird finding its nest tampered, and now it's difficult to come anew. The glass is scored, the rivets warping, a building in decline, and a fool taping the leaves back onto the trees. Thank you. And this one is called A Poem for Little Al. Nobody knew what the hell you were talking about the day you walked out of a Flannery O'Connor story and yelped to the congregation that you had done a terrible thing. And everyone knew it was the wrong place, your wife sitting only aisles away with a strawberry basket headdress like every Sunday, stoic, admirable in her distance. I was only 14 and my parents were not equipped to explain that you'd done this over the years, a feeble song and dance meant for some evangelical backwood. But I knew the spot they mentioned later in your obituary, where at 17 we had found access to drugs. And the paper said that you were known in this neighborhood as Little Al. The paper also said you spent upwards of a day in the corner of a room in a project before someone alerted the police about the pistol whipping that fractured your skull. Perhaps your skull was just extra soft, and those days in church never prepared you for a neighborhood where you had no business. When you were in intensive care, I imagine that your wife visited you, and I would like to think that she told you this, but I know that she's a better person than you or I. Thanks.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you. And please welcome Joe Calden. Joe, there he is.
Nightlife, part two. I used to agonize, lose sleep even, over what clothes to wear, what cologne to wear for a night out. What to say, what to do, when one moment was the only moment left. It's different now, the internet in the air around us. Through experience, anecdote, and Wikipedia, I've learned women never truly get over their first love. Until they do. And I'm left here at closing time, an empty shot glass. Her treat, her first night out in years, her kiss on the lips, a divorcee who will never, ever go on a date with me. Thank you.
So it's really nice to have Jack Hopkins back, and we haven't seen him for a while. Please welcome Jack Hopkins.
Well, I guess we all know my name. Yeah, I'm from Greensburg. A pleasure to be here. This is really, the feedback is, okay. All right, let's jump right in. My blues don't sound like Robert Johnson. My blues are the seven-note stair step of violent trumpets descending in lockstep with doom-filled snares, treading, treading. My blues stride by in the wash of brazen sound, slipping, sliding, draining down the cracked streets. My blues march the timeless page, each debt due. All right. This is just great for me. Okay. This sweet baby showed up 8 days ago. If I get a little verklempt, don't worry about it. And I do need my backup. Hang on. Being Mary Oliver. He breaks open my heart this night in Evergreen State. Me on the center. Now, you know what? I thought I had it. Let's do that again. This is just a reading. This is not a dramatic performance. And I need my glasses, too. No, I don't. Okay. Being Mary Oliver, he breaks open my heart that night at One last time. He breaks open my heart this night at Evergreen State. Me, uncomfortable on a folding chair in the center of the floor, all around, no one I know. And they edge away in every cardinal direction as he repeats three lines, louder, hectoring. But me, you, but me, weeping from the first, you do not have to be good. Sobbing through the second round of, you do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert, repenting. Then he coos, you only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. David White cradles my heart complete in someone else's poem. Thank you.
And finally tonight, unless there's someone else who has just not fessed up, they really want to read a poem tonight. Okay, okay. Then our last poet reading in the Hemingway 2018 series in the open mic is Bob Ziller. Please welcome Bob.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I hold in my hands the last poem. The last poem will be sung by a sobbing nightingale beneath the famous moon. The last poem will have a frog jump into it. The last poem will make diamonds out of coal. The last poem will feature superheroes of the soul. The last poem will dance on the banks of the River Thames and take a lobster for a walk. The last poem will juggle coconuts. The last poem shall be compared to a summer's day. The last poem will be recycled and sold as rolling papers at the neighborhood bodega. The last poem will be handcuffed for having too much fun. The last poem will have breasts like cantaloupes. The last poem will feel the sap rise in its loins. The last poem will have an afterglow like deer tracks in the freshly fallen snow. The last poem will dream that it's a butterfly, then sit in the lotus posture and disappear. The last poem, disguised as a cherub wearing diapers, will fill all the holes in the ozone layer. The last poem will save the rainforest, then get a star on Hollywood Boulevard. The last poem will weep on a battlefield strewn with corpses. The last poem will be destroyed by religious fascists. The last poem will be memorized by the ghost of Homer. The last poem will be scrawled on the stall of a public bathroom, and it will say, "I wrote this to make asses laugh." The last poem will run away with the circus. The last poem will be abducted by space aliens. The last poem will lick its eyebrows and seduce a Martian. The last poem will avoid saying anything obscene just to get on TV. The last poem will wrestle bears and speak of unspeakable things. The last poem will be read by a cyclops. The last poem will return from the astral plane and declare, "Make life beautiful." The last poem will have Charlie Chaplin walk through it. The last poem will step into the post office and see its heart on a wanted poster. The last poem will fight a duel with water pistols. The last poem will lift the blindfold off of justice. The last poem will see angels where there's only clouds. The last poem will give thanks to God and the great penguin. The last poem, of course, will be rejected by publishers. The last poem will be written by a cockroach. The last poem will put condoms on all the missiles. The last poem will laugh as a sword passes through its immaterial body. The last poem, I assure you, will be placed in a government file because secret police everywhere love poetry. The last poem will vote with its feet. The last poem will demonstrate that orange rhymes with door hinge. The last poem will look so far into the future, it'll see the back of its head. The last poem will hustle roses down the avenues of the dead. The last poem will be recited by a dim-witted egomaniac with a sardonic smile. The last poem, being timeless, will be disqualified from the poetry contest. The last poem will sound a tuning fork on a grapefruit. The last poem will somersault into the light. The last poem is stored in a piñata. The last poem will smile at the foot of the ladder. The last poem will ride a moose into the sunset, gazing at flowers that whisper love. The last poem, the last poem. The last poem will be written the day after the last day. That's all, folks. Thank you. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Don. Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you all for, it was a great summer. Really, really great readings all summer. Thank you.